The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look, and I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, Senate Bill 140 is now headed to Governor Brian Kemp's desk. This Republican-led bill would ban most medical and hormone treatments for transgender youth to affirm their gender identity. There's been support and opposition to the measure, and it has fallen along party lines. Well, today we're going to hear from faith leaders. Also, the mission of the Southern Black Girls and Women's Consortium. Well, it's to help fund other organizations that are doing grassroots work. We'll talk all about that, important conversations. But as always, we begin with news from the state capitol. A school voucher bill is on the move. A state house committee made a number of changes to the bill yesterday before it passed. That includes increasing the voucher to $6,500 a year per student. Parents could use the money for private school tuition, tutoring, and therapy. The bill's lead sponsor, Republican State Senator Greg Dolezal, explains who would be eligible.
Students who are attending a school that would be deemed to be in the bottom 25%, so the bottom quartile of schools in the state of Georgia.
Opponents say public tax dollars should not be diverted away from public schools. Others raise concerns about the lack of private school options in some rural parts of Georgia. Senate Bill 233 is waiting to be scheduled for a House vote. And a bill that would ban vaping in public spaces in the same way smoking is banned has also passed. The measure now goes to Governor Brian Kemp for his signature or veto. Republican State Representative Sharon Cooper is the House sponsor of the legislation.
It puts vaping on the same status as smoking cigarettes. It does not expand anything. It just says, if you can't smoke in an area, you can't vape in an area.
Now, Georgia's 2005 Smoke-Free Air Act says people can't smoke indoors in many public spaces, although it excludes some places, for example, tobacco stores and bars that only admit patrons older than 18. And get this, a violation of the law could be a fine from $100 to $500. A bill that would define anti-Semitism in Georgia has stalled after the addition of an amendment in a Senate committee altered the measure. Sponsors say a definition would help prosecutors and other officials identify hate crimes and illegal discrimination targeting Jewish people. But they asked to have the bill set aside after the Senate Judiciary Committee adopted an amendment that defines anti-Semitism in ways they disagree with. So the bill sponsor says he doesn't know if the bill is dead for the remainder of the legislative session, which ends March 29th. And some critics warn it would limit free speech, especially in criticizing the actions of the state of Israel. We'll keep an eye on that. A key Georgia Senate committee has passed the proposed $32 billion state budget. Now, Senate budget writers are backing Governor Brian Kemp's proposal to pay 100% tuition for all Hope Scholars in Georgia's public colleges and universities. But House budget writers want to pay 100% only for higher-achieving Zell Miller Hope Scholars, while moving all other Hope Scholars from 90% to 95% tuition. I hope y'all got all of that. Senate Appropriations Committee Chair Blake Tillery says this chamber is also proposing accelerated implementation of a 2019 law on dyslexia screening for next school year.
The Senate committee version you have before you now fully funds that measure 1 year early and supports screening, dyslexia screening for all children from kindergarten to third grade.
And like so many other measures, any differences between the House and Senate have to be worked out before next Wednesday. In other news, Georgia is approaching a national deadline to begin reevaluating Medicaid recipients. And advocates say the state needs to do more to prevent people from losing coverage in the process, as we hear from Jess Mador.
More than 2.5 million Georgians use Medicaid or Peach Care for kids. And beginning next month, the state has just over a year to reevaluate everyone's eligibility for the program. Because of the pandemic, Medicaid has been required to maintain continuous coverage. Georgia Budget and Policy Institute analyst Leah Chan says hundreds of thousands of people could lose insurance for avoidable reasons.
It means parents saddled with crushing medical debt when their kid has an asthma attack and they leave the ER with a bill that they can't pay. Teenagers struggling with suicidal ideation, not being able to get access to the treatment they need.
A Department of Human Services spokesperson says all Medicaid recipients will be notified more than a month before their individual case is reevaluated. Jess Mador, WABE News.
And finally, that is Chawa, the Grammy-nominated Mardi Gras Indian funk band based out of New Orleans. Now, they performed last year during the Candler Park Music Festival. And if you were there for the band or any other artists, I need you to hold on to that memory, because after 11 years, the festival is coming to an end. In a short statement, organizers said the festival will not return this year, saying, quote, "As we embrace this necessary change, we look forward to what's next." Close quote. The statement did not provide a specific reason for the cancellation, but the move follows the end of Music Midtown, it appears, after owner Live Nation could not ban attendees from bringing guns onto public parkland, at least that's what some said, due to Georgia's 2022 gun law. Stay tuned as we look into more what's going to happen with Atlanta music festivals moving forward. That's coming up on a earlier in the future edition of Closer Look. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. When it comes to philanthropic funding for initiatives solely focusing on women and girls, there is a lot of money out there. We do know that. However, according to a report from the Ms. Foundation for Women and the consulting group Strength in Numbers, less than 1% of, get this, $67 billion that foundations contributed in 2017 went to organizations specifically supporting women and girls of color. Again, less than 1%. And in 2018, that number dropped to less than 0.5%. That's according to research from the Black Feminist Fund. Well, here in the South, there's an organization working to bring about change in this area, particularly as it relates to the lives of Black women and girls through philanthropy, activism, and empowerment. It's called the Southern Black Girls and Women's Consortium, also known as Southern Black Girls. And joining me now to talk more about this is Malika Berry Rogers, the executive director of the organization. Welcome.
Hey, how are you doing?
Do I qualify as a Southern Black girl yet?
Absolutely.
I'm from the Midwest. You know, I'm from St. Louis, but I've been here since 96. So
I think you count. I mean, I grew up here and I've not left.
Those numbers, those statistics that I read coming into this segment, that's not lost on you. Mm-mm. Just when you think about $67 billion, this was back in 2017, and less than 1% of that $67 billion of foundations that went to organizations supporting women and girls of color.
There were about four pieces of data that came to us in addition to the work, the great work that the Ms. Foundation did. Another organization called the Southern Rural Women's Initiative did a similar landscape analysis to understand what the funding looks like. Mm-hmm. Southern Black Girls and Women's Consortium were not only concerned about that number, but thought it was disproportionate in connection to what Southern Black women and girls contribute to the culture, mm-hmm. to social justice, to politics. And that was out of balance. And so that information, plus in around the same time, 2017, 2018, there were a few studies around the adultification of girls. Mm-hmm. And so not only are girls going to school and being disproportionately disciplined because they are treated like adults, mm-hmm. not children, all of that information together said, we are waiting for philanthropy to recognize us. What we need to do is have our own model to do our own work to take care of our girls and invite philanthropy to our table.
Well, and also think about if these are the numbers for Black girls and women, imagine what the numbers might be for indigenous folks, mm-hmm. or our Latinas, or any other population that is labeled under this underserved, you know, however you want to view that. So if you, someone say, well, okay, well, having your own model may work, but why not fight to make sure there's inclusion in that $67 billion in 2017? That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. And so I would say that our model does fight for inclusion in that work. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we recognize is that if we were to look at the contributions of Black women specifically, we understand that when Black women care for reproductive rights, do reproductive justice, those benefits actually spill out beyond Black women and Black communities. Mm-hmm. They extend to other communities of color. If we even look at the civil rights movement, because Black people did that work, we got the Americans with a Disabilities Act. So we get spillover benefit in any of these social justice movements. So I would love to share that it's not a model that is insular to Black girls and women only, but it is a starting point mm-hmm. because the benefits reach so far beyond us.
The tentacles, in other words, the resources and services you're providing, the tentacles from that spill out into all other areas, quality of life areas, mm-hmm. which, you know, that it's a number. So yeah. You're saying not just focus on, well, this is just for Black girls, and we don't have anything for Black girls and Black women. Just think beyond that, is what you're saying.
We're going to start with Black girls and women because we don't often start with Black girls and women. We assume that they're going to be okay. So we want to start with ourselves and then absolutely be intentional about how we take care of ourselves, but recognize our benefit is to benefit for everyone else.
As someone who works for a nonprofit and who understands the importance of connecting with the community, because the bottom line is, as I learned a long time ago, people want to be a part of something that you're involved mm-hmm. in, whatever that is. So when you talk about the community, you may have the community on board, but now you got to reach the people with the money, mm-hmm. the funding. So how are you all, is there anything different about how you all are trying to reach the same individuals that say this, these other organizations are trying to get to as well?
I would say that our greatest distinction, there are two great distinctions, is the organizations that founded us. We are founded by four Black women leaders in philanthropy. The leaders of the Black Belt Community Foundation, the Appalachian Community Foundation, True Speaks Innovation Fund, and Fund for Southern Communities. These four women have, over the course of their careers, moved millions of dollars to the South. What they recognize is that data you started with mm-hmm. is actually a gap that we could change together.
How long y'all been around?
We've been around, we've been doing grant making since 2018, but we've been doing the work since about 2017, 2018. Before we sent out a dollar, we actually sat down to do what we call listening sessions. Evaluators will call focus groups. But what we wanted to do was to hear from the girls what they say they needed so that we directed our funding in the right places.
So when we talk about this southern region, are we just looking at, and often you've heard of the Southern Black Belt, which is an area that looks at a lot of disparities, particularly with a lot within health inequities. Is that the same region we're talking about?
Yeah, 13-state region. Mm-hmm. So from Texas to Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, up to Kentucky, North Carolina, South Carolina, West Virginia. Those states, plus many others that I've left out, that's 13 states. It is the former slave region.
Mm-hmm. So how do you all, and there's so many, how have you all been able to identify, or do you have a list of, we know these are the top buckets, the areas for Southern Black women and girls we want to address? I imagine health and wellness is a big part of that.
Yes.
Education, mm-hmm. I'm assuming.
Yeah, you're sitting in our table, right, with us right here.
I'm at the table.
You're at the table. So what we did was we did those listening sessions, and we came up with five broad areas.
Now, who'd you listen to?
We listened to hundreds of girls across 12 states. At the time, Texas wasn't part of our group, but they now are, so welcome, Texas. But we listened to hundreds of Black girls across 12 states, and we had sessions where they told us what their lives were like, and we asked two things of them, what they needed and how they perceived themselves in America. And so some of that research we created on our own told us that they wanted schools to be opportunities of places of opportunity rather than places of racism. Mm-hmm. They were concerned about health and wellness and the economic opportunity in their own home. They were worried about the economic disparities and hardships in their own homes. They were worried about whether or not their schools actually were good schools. They knew themselves to be resilient, but they weren't sure they were smart enough. Mm-hmm. And so that information said to us what we need to fund are leadership development opportunities. We need to fund education and travel opportunities. We need to spend fund economic development opportunities, health and wellness, and also a space for them to be social justice warriors that they are, because they see the misalignment in their communities, and a lot of girls want to move toward that.
Mm-hmm. So now you've had the listening session, and every executive director and leader that comes in here, when I ask them that question, I don't know if this is in a playbook, but y'all say, we listen. So I think that's a good thing. So you listen, mm-hmm. and then now you got to spring into action.
Yeah.
So what was that next phase?
The next phase was actually to provide what we call Black Girl Joy Awards.
I didn't get one.
Well, you have to be between 12 and 24, and I left that behind a long time ago.
You know I'm not 22.
And so what we ask girls to do, our peers in philanthropy often ask, what are your deficits and how do we fulfill them?
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what we decided to do was something a little revolutionary, a little asymmetrical, and say, what are your dreams? What would bring you joy? And let's fund that. Because what we understand is if we give them an opportunity to see beyond where they are, mm-hmm. then they can get there and we can be of support with them. So our Black Girl Joy Awards ask girls to tell us their idea for joy. And we offer $550 to those winning applications that are able to show us joy.
What did you hear? Can you share? Is there something that stood out for you?
Absolutely. So the first year we did it, there were two friends, and it was at the height of COVID. So we were funding at the height of COVID, and they wanted their families and friends to be together. So they did what they called a Brown Girls movie theater. And they asked their friends and family to come to a park, and they parked their cars. And the filmmakers for Black Panther heard about them and gave them access to the film. So their neighborhood had their own screening of Black Panther. We have another young girl this past year. She really thought it would bring her joy to make sure her track team had uniforms. The team was in North Carolina. She's 14 years old. And so she used her $550 to buy uniforms for the rest of her team because they were in their own T-shirts and mm-hmm. and basketball shorts from the boys' basketball team. And so she did this for herself. Another young girl used her money to continue her dream to offer art to other kids in her school because the art program is gone. So these girls are selfless, and they are sharing what they believe to be their joy with other young women.
With what you just told our listeners and what you just told me, it's those types of conversations, that type of work that's being done in the communities that sometimes, and I've heard folks say this, I'm not making it up, that the grant making folks, they don't get to hear that. They're looking on paper.
Yeah.
You know, when people submit their you know, requests for funding, not all of them,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them, but not all of them. So they don't get to see and really hear that. So is this also a testament that perhaps the process needs to change? You know, before you just look at the paperwork of the organization, if you're a funder, somehow really get into the grassroots and get to the ground level of what these folks are doing and what kids want to do.
You really are a Southern Black girl, because that's exactly what we did. We poured that cup out and we started all over again. We said, whatever traditional philanthropy does, what we want to do first is to center Black girls and women in the process. Let's create an application process that actually works for Black girls and women.
Mm-hmm.
Let's create an awards and a process that is actually going to speak to their lives and how we know we need to use the money. Let's not penalize women for not having a 501c3. Let's find them a fiscal sponsor. Let's find ways that we, in fact, can give money. The other distinction is that we have a network of Black women in those communities, because big philanthropy cannot often see that 14-year-old who's funding her team's sports.
You know, if we were in church, people would be saying, amen. That's right. So how do you all get your money?
We do what every other nonprofit does.
Ask.
We ask. We ask. And believe me, we ask. But we also have friends in philanthropy. As I mentioned earlier, our leaders, the women who founded this work, are really well-heeled and well-known in philanthropic circles. So they made opened recommendations to us and things and such. We have been able to not only have some really extraordinary seed funding from foundations who understood our vision and jumped on with us, mm-hmm. but we've been able to kind of meet new friends. Like this year, we are an awardee of Comic Relief Red Nose Day. So we are part of their national campaign mm-hmm. to spread Black girl joy.
So, you know, the next question is, so did Oprah, Mackenzie Scott, Queen Bee, did they send you a check?
Not yet, but we still ask it. We're asking.
How much are y'all able to disperse on an annual basis thus far?
In an annual basis, we give away about $1 million or $1.2 million a year.
And I know you want that to increase.
We do. We do. Because if we were to fund every woman who put together an application for us, every organization, we fund Black women-led, most times Black women-created, Black girls-serving organizations across 13 states. If we were to fund every one of those organizations as richly as they need to be funded, it would be a $100 million ask.
I have a listener who says, Rose, can you ask her to explain or to define Black-led, because Black is in many different ethnicities and race, which is true.
Yeah. So when
Black in the African diaspora or just?
We are talking about Black in the African diaspora. We have a group in Nashville that works with young girls, and the majority of their girls are from immigrant families that are African families in Nashville. Mm-hmm. They are still Southern Black girls.
I understand that you all helped a young lady from Atlanta to achieve her dream of performing at the Super Bowl with, you know who?
Yes.
Miss Thing up there, Rihanna.
Yes. We are still smiling.
Or as my uncle says, I like that Rihanna girl. That's what he says, folks. Forgive him. How did y'all do this?
We have an incredible partnership with the Pete and Thomas Foundation, which is the private and personal foundation of rap artist Megan Thee Stallion. Mm-hmm. And
I like Meg.
We all do.
Meg's cool.
She's, I mean, you have no idea. Like
holding her own, and that's what's cool.
Because she's loved us so much, we cannot tell you how cool she is. She came and said, I want to do that with you all. And you're picking us up out of nowhere. Nobody knows who we are. Mm-hmm. But she really wanted to do two things. She wanted to share her message of mental health with girls, because mm-hmm. that's important. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to actually identify herself with girls so they can see a possibility to be a Southern Black girl.
She sees these text messages and folks, tell her about my organization. I ain't doing that for y'all.
I do want to know now. I do want to
know. They got to go through the process like everybody else.
Yes. So she's really been an advocate, a partner in helping us do our work. And so we told her on our bus tour, we had our inaugural Joy is Our Journey bus tour, 8 cities, 5 states, thousands of girls mm-hmm. across those states. And one young lady said, I want to dance in the Super Bowl. So we called Rock Nation. Mm-hmm. Rock Nation talked to the Pete and Thomas Foundation. The conversations continued. So from July 2022 to February 2023, Jemiah Swinney danced in the Super Bowl.
Wow.
And it was incredible. We were all at home. We weren't with her in the Super Bowl, but we smiled as hard as she did.
But I want to go back to also just understanding, and you know, we've been having a great time with this conversation, but again, when you hear about how much there is available, mm-hmm. and philanthropy is, you know, it's nothing new, obviously, and it appears that one could argue there is, whether it's intentional or not, a dismissive or even biasness, I guess, yeah. of when it comes to certain populations, because they feel like, oh, it's this group here, and they want this, and you know, perhaps it doesn't fall in line with. But if you're helping people, then why do we have this disparity when it comes to philanthropy and funding organizations that specifically are focusing on Black women and girls?
So I think the answer to that is twofold. There's an overall disinvestment in the South. Mm-hmm. And then there is an overall disinvestment in gender-specific girls programming. And Black women and girls often live in that space between racial disparity and racial discrimination and gender discrimination. And so it's so much worse for Southern Black girls, because not only are they Black girls, but they're in a region that has been historically disinvested in. Mm-hmm. And if we don't take care of these Black girls, we may not meet the next Rosa Parks. We may not meet the next Septima Clark. We may not meet the next Rose Scott if we don't.
She's out there.
Yeah. She's out there. But we have to give her something to look forward to. We have to let her know that we are out here for her.
And finally, because I do have emails about this, if folks want to get in front of you all at the table to talk about their organization, or even just partner with you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, what's that process like? You have, you know, Is it a screening process first? Mm-hmm. What's the vetting process like?
We have an open application for our grant making. We do a large grant making usually in the second or third quarter of a fiscal year. So we've just closed. And in the next month, you can watch our social media and our website. We'll be congratulating those who receive the Black Girl Dream Award, mm-hmm. which is a grant roughly between $30,000 for Black women-led, created, mm-hmm. and Black girl-serving organizations across the South. We also do Black Girl Joy Awards. Those are those 550 challenge grants. And so organizations have to simply attend a grant seeker workshop with mm-hmm. us for that opportunity.
And when's the next...
It won't be for another few months, but I would.
Because your fiscal year is July 1 to July. Okay.
Yes, exactly. January. But I would share that even though the grant cycle is closed for this year right now, or hasn't opened yet for this year, please join us at our next conference. That is an opportunity for us to get to know you. We met hundreds of organizations in our first bus tour. We meet hundreds more at our annual conference, and that puts you on our radar to kind of get to know you. We are having a conference June 9th and 10th in Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay.
So come join us. It's on our website now already. Registration is open, and it is free. It is free. And if you have 10 or more girls that you're bringing with you, you can apply for a travel stipend.
I have a text. Love me some Malika.
Ah!
I can't tell you who said that. Malika Berry Rogers, the executive director of the Southern Black Girls and Women's Consortium. Thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
And there is a little Rose Scott out there somewhere.
There is. There is.
She wants to do her own show somewhere.
Yep, she does.
I'll support her.
Good, good.
Thank you so much, Malika.
Thank you. Thank you.
This bill protects children who are struggling with their gender identity issues from being pushed into decisions that will alter their bodies forever. We are banning doctors in Georgia from doing medical facilities and medical facilities from treating gender dysphoria in children through hormones or surgery because we know most of these children issues will resolve themselves hopefully when they become young adults.
Many of these young people, the mental weight that is upon them is so great and so grave that without receiving some type of medical treatment, they just can't stand to see themselves in the mirror, right? They can't stand to hear somebody call them by a pronoun that doesn't match their identity. It's so painful for them. And so, you know, to ask them to wait until they're 18 is just not reasonable.
But there are a lot of children who are confused and don't necessarily know the right thing and are using this as what they think is the right solution when it's not. And unfortunately, once you do certain steps in a gender transition, you can't go back.
You know, when you're talking to a 14-year-old and telling them they have to wait until they're 18, that's 4 years, and that's a long time to have gender dysphoria, and that's a long time to have suicidal ideations and try to protect them for 4 years. So it's going to be hard, and it's going to be difficult.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. It's a measure that's been debated with passion and emotion. Senate Bill 140. The measure is now headed to Governor Brian Kemp's desk for either his signature or veto. Closer Look contacted Governor Kemp's office to gauge if he had a timeline regarding the fate of this bill. In a statement to Closer Look, a spokesperson responded with this, quote, "There is not currently a timetable on Senate Bill 140. Once the bill reaches the governor's desk, it will undergo a thorough review process by our office, and we will make an announcement once any decision is made," close quote. Meanwhile, this controversial bill has opponents and supporters within the faith community. And that's where our next conversation begins. Joining the program today, Mike Griffin, who serves in the Public Affairs Ministry of the Georgia Baptist Mission Board And joining me here in studio, Reverend Dr. Josh Noblett, Faith Coordinator for Georgia Equality. I want to thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Reverend Noblett, I want to start with you. I know about your organization. I've covered it many times, Georgia Equality. But for some listeners who may not, just for clarity, what's the mission of Georgia Equality?
Yeah, Georgia Equality has been around for a number of decades and is the organization here in the state of Georgia that advocates on behalf of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and all the other letters that go with that after that, for equality, both in policy and practice in the state of Georgia.
And Mr. Griffin, for those not familiar with the Georgia Baptist Mission Board.
Yes, I'm the public affairs representative with Georgia Baptist Mission Board, and we represent approximately 1.5 million Georgians, Georgia Baptist, Southern Baptist combined, mm-hmm. and have about 3,400 churches that we represent. So we're the largest faith group in the state. And I'm down here representing Georgia Baptist on different ethical issues mm-hmm. and policy issues. This is my 16th year at the Capitol, my 10th year with Georgia Baptist.
Oh. And I want to stay with you for a moment, Mr. Griffin, because I'm curious, does your organization, are all the churches involved here, do you have a stance or an opinion on gender affirming care in general?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. In 2019, we passed a resolution at the Georgia Baptist Convention that meets annually, a resolution on gender dysphoria and its treatment. So we did come out with that in response to some of the early legislation that was introduced. And so we did come out on that.
And where do you all align? I mean, and is it based in scripture?
Yeah. So we believe that, you know, God created male and female in his image, Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. And we talk a little bit about that. I sent that a copy to y'all. Mm-hmm. I have a copy of it there before you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we believe we live in a broken, sin-sick culture, which we're all part of. And it's left many innocent children without even a vital foundation of the certainty about their own God-given sex. And so, you know, families of gender dysphoric children are seeking answers mm-hmm. From the mental health and medical communities to try to help them. And our heart breaks with them, and we're burdened with them about that need.
Well, let me ask you this before I get to my guests here in the studio. Do you all offer any guidance or counseling for families in this area?
We just recommend that mental health issues be dealt with psychotherapists, and that they go and that they deal with those issues, because we really believe that a lot of this is more culturally driven than it is biologically driven in our day.
Okay. And Reverend here in the studio, I want you to comment on what you heard, but just quickly, when we talk about gender affirming care, through your lens, is there also a misconception about what people think it is and what it actually is? I'm talking about gender affirming care just in general. You know?
Yeah. And I'm also a licensed marriage and family therapist myself and counsel many transgender folks in my own private practice. Gender affirming care is a long process that involves counseling, both individual counseling, couples counseling if the person is in a relationship, family counseling for youth and their families that are a part of this process. It is a long process. And in order to even move forward with any type of gender-affirming medical interventions, there has to be a second opinion by a separate mental health practitioner.
Mr. Griffin, you heard what the Reverend said here. Your thoughts and your response?
Well, again, we feel like that minors should be placed in a position where they are on other various issues, that they need to wait till they're old enough to make those kinds of decisions that are going to be permanent. And if we go in a direction that they're not able to return back to, that's going to be very detrimental. You know, we've looked at this from, you know, a legal, science, and moral issue. You know, from a legal issue, you know, there are all types of things that we deal with every day, from drinking alcohol, smoking cigarettes, tattoos. There are all types of standards that are set forward that are required. You look at it from a science issue. I mean, we're male and female no matter what at birth. And then 400 years from now, if you were dug up and checked your DNA, you're going to be a male or a female.
But you just you told me a while ago, and I want to be clear. You all do believe that therapy and counseling, the family should seek that. I just want to be clear.
Absolutely. That they need to seek that and work with that young person till they get to 18 years of age. And if they need to make any other decisions by way of a transitional type of medical treatments, then there's certainly that would be something that they would, that would be up to them to consider. The problem is you're living in a day when 80 to 90% of those who go through some of these surgeries and different medical treatments will then come back and say, well, I wish I had waited a little longer till I could have worked through this. So we think that there are always a lot of other issues that are being dealt with by young people, mm-hmm. Other mental issues that need to be dealt with, autism, ADHD, other mental health problems before receiving the diagnosis of gender dysphoria.
And Mr. Griffin, I want you to fact check. You said 80 to 90%. Where is that source? Where are you getting that from?
Well, the one I'm looking at here just came the other day, and it was someone who actually had a clinic that dealt with gender dysphoria and having surgeries and types of, which the lady's no longer doing that anymore. And she was saying those that went through their clinic, 87.8% of the boys that were referred to their gender identity clinic eventually desisted. In other words, they stopped believing that they were girls and went back to being a boy.
Where was this clinic? On. Can you tell us? And I want.
I think it was in Canada.
Okay, Reverend,
where do I begin? What I heard my colleague from the that just spoke cite 80 to 90% of what? I'm not even clear what that statistic is referring to. And we have to be real careful when we throw out these random numbers because we're talking about real people's lives. And one of the things that we see over and over and over for those of us who are licensed by the state to provide mental and medical care to mm-hmm. folks in the transgender community is that, and these are statistics that were published by the Department of Health and Human Services, 86% of transgender youth have seriously considered suicide. 56% of them have actually tried it, and many of them have completed that suicide act. And that gender-affirming care, and again, studies have been done about this, has dramatically reduced suicide ideation, social isolation, depression, anxiety, self-harming behaviors, all those things. And that's what we want to do is try to reduce this harm that is happening to these young folks.
Mr. Griffin, the Reverend is talking about reducing harm to youth. Your response to that, because for an organization like yours, where you admit you all want folks, households to seek therapy and counseling, but you are saying that you want the kids to wait till they're 18. But when you hear these other statistics, can you understand the other side of this?
Well, there are other issues regarding the suicide emphasis. And I've also noticed, even just in a recent statement, I was looking at it a year while ago, where even a LGBT organization talked about the fact that you don't need to be talking about those things. It has the tendency to encourage them to go toward the suicide direction if you continually talk about it. I mean, Movement Advancement Project, which is an LGBT advocacy group, said don't attribute a suicide death to a single factor such as bullying or discrimination, or say that a specific anti-LGBT law or policy will cause suicide. So we have to be careful. And again, this has exponentially went really up since about 2011. And many are saying, if they don't get this treatment, they're going to be suicidal. Well, we didn't see these suicide rates when there was no treatment at all before 2011, for example. If this was true, then it would have already been happening if it was truly a biological issue. And so we're concerned that it's a mental issue and it's a cultural issue that we're living in today. And our young people need to be given some patience and be given that psychotherapy that will help them to be able to deal with any mental issues or other contributing issues they may be going through in their life.
Reverend Noblet?
again, what I heard my colleague say is just don't talk about it, and that way it'll magically go away. One of the reasons that we are able to identify this is because we are talking about it and because we are taking the time to learn about these people's lives and understand their families, their painful journey through what is gender dysphoria, which is the painful discomfort that comes from how one perceives their own gender identity and versus the gender that they have been assigned at birth, and the extreme discomfort that comes from living in that tension. And you know, again, part of the reason that this hasn't been identified before is because it has flown largely under the radar. People are ashamed to talk about these kind of things, especially in schools. Kids who are dealing with gender, with their own sexuality. I myself was bullied extensively as a gay man in middle school, and it brings about suicide ideation as a way of getting out from underneath that pain.
Mr. Griffin, if the rules of morality, they're not mandates or commands, but they are beliefs. Laws, on the other hand, are different, and there are rules that are mandated by a country or a community. Can you understand someone saying Senate Bill 140 tramples all over that because it should not, as opponents of the bill say, this should not be about some type of morality or belief. It should be about what is constitutionally right for a household to do with their youth.
Right. Well, you're saying constitutionally right, so you're bringing morality into it as well. And the morality here is that we need to defend the rights of that child till they get old enough to make adult decisions that they cannot be able to do anything about as they get older. We do that all the time, and I think it's important that they be protected so that they can make those long life-term decisions, and that we need to love and care and minister to them. I agree with them. It is not right for anyone to be bullied. It's not right for people to be treated differently because they don't agree with them. I have friends, in the homosexual lesbian community I've talked with. I know my partner here, as we're talking here today, I know his boss. I mean, we talk in the hall here, and I've said this in committee, I love the LGBT community. I'm not hating them. I don't want to mistreat them at all. I want them to be respected. But I also am concerned about children who are in transitional periods mentally and physically. They need to get to that age that they can make that personal decision themselves and get the counseling and encourage them.
Mr. Griffin, studies, and there is data out here that reveals that it is a very, very small percentage of youth that even proceed with the surgery. This is a therapy that there's a lot of other therapies and processes involved here. What's your response to that?
Well, the cross hormone type treatments, the puberty blockers, all of them end up doing some irreprehensible type of damage. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at a survey. Of course, I know you're talking about a full, complete. Mm-hmm. But I mean, a survey from Sweden found that adult transsexuals who had undergone full medical transition had a suicide rate that was actually 19 times higher. So it doesn't always help. It actually ends up hurting sometimes. So again, it's just pushing a pause button and saying we want to defend people's rights, but we want to also make sure that young people are not coerced into making these decisions.
I have to just say, I don't think there were dozens, if not hundreds, of parents, medical providers, and transgender youth themselves who came down to the Capitol in this process. Not one of them has been coerced in this process. In fact, if anything, the families have gone through extensive discernment to make sure that this is what, you know, that this is going to be the thing that helps our child to survive, that helps our child to live a life that is free of all this pain and distress that goes along with gender identity. The idea that this is being imposed on children, nothing could be further from the truth. One of the other things I want to just acknowledge is that on the other side of this issue, I acknowledge that there are folks that honestly think that they are trying to help children here. And sometimes the best intentions, if not carefully thought out and studied, lead to disastrous consequences, such as will be the case with this legislation if the governor chooses to sign it. It just breaks my heart that folks are not willing to listen to parents, especially. We make all kinds of provisions for parents about not forcing their kids to wear masks in COVID, to not get vaccinated, you know, around sex education, what their kids are exposed to in school. But when it comes to this particular issue, that we're not willing to trust the wisdom and the relationships that parents have with their own children in discerning this extensively complicated and painful process.
Mr. Griffin? Your response to that?
Well, I think we're in a cultural coercion that's going on here today where kids are being pressured and pushed.
By who?
And by the culture, whether it's social media or the left or whoever, whatever. I mean, just simply saying this was not seen 20 years ago. And so if this was purely biological, then we would have been seeing this all along. It's just simply skyrocketed over the last 15 to 20 years.
Transgender people have existed since the dawn of time. I mean, even in the Bible, we have references to eunuchs and others that are gender nonconforming, even in our own scriptural text that we share. This is not a new phenomenon. Just the way that we are beginning to have some compassion and understanding of it is the new part.
Well, according to the scripture, we are born male or female.
But we also, scientifically, there are intersex people that exist.
That view. Right.
People that are born with both genders who are intersect, those folks also exist in our creation.
Right, that's a very, very small percentage. And we live in a sin sick fallen world where sin has impacted humans, it's impacted nature.
I guess the difficulty that I have is that you just got through saying that we're created male and female. That is not the complete truth in terms of the biological diversity that exists in our creation.
Well, again, we've had that sinful impact that's made its impact on all of our lives, everybody, including all three of us. We've had impacts.
Mr. Griffin, in 2020, when there was a lot of protests dealing with the murder of George Floyd, and you all put out a statement, a declaration, and you ended it by saying you wanted to make sure there was equality and fairness for all people. Can you understand someone understanding why you all did that, but for some, supporting this type of legislation directly counters that?
Again, it's about protecting the innocence of children that need to be done, and that's supreme. Jesus said, and it'd be better a millstone hung about our neck, tossed into the deepest part of the sea to cause one of these little ones to stumble. That's where we're at, and we think that we should protect them. And again, we think this is a cultural shift that has happened, that is having a very negative impact on our children. And psychotherapy is the way to help them, education, teaching them about their identity, having been created in the image of God. We're to respect and love all people, even if we disagree with them.
And Reverend Dr. Josh Knoblett, I'll give you the last word.
My understanding is that God is love. That's my whole theology about this. And when we see kids that are contemplating taking their own lives, which suicide, as we know, is irreversible as well, we can't help but try to act in compassion, try to help these kids understand that there is a way forward that involves affirming who they are, that they are loved and are surrounded by a community that will also support them. And that's what we're trying to do by blocking this legislation, is to show that they, too, are welcome in Georgia and that they are part of our families.
Reverend Dr. Josh Knoblett, Faith Coordinator for Georgia Equality. Mike Griffin, who serves in the Public Affairs Ministry of the Georgia Baptist Mission Board. Thank you both for taking the time. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having this important conversation.
Thank you, Rose. God bless you.
Thank you. And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Soria Vanderwerth. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other, you can always send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online, wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. And also, reminder, we're out and about tomorrow. It's Coffee Conversations with Rose. Yes, we'll be in East Atlanta, where they have a lot of interesting restaurants and businesses. I love y'all. Joe's Coffee House, I believe. Yeah, we're going to be there. So come out and hang out with us and have a cup of coffee. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.